Lecture 19, Sartre on Emotions and Responsibility.
The idea that emotions are choices informs one of Sartre's first philosophical publications. In the late 30s, more than 5 years before he would publish Being and Nothingness, he writes actually a huge manuscript. In fact, I don't think Sartre writes any small manuscripts. Sartre wrote a huge manuscript which was to be called The Psyche. But of that work, we only have one piece of it, the piece he published in 1938, which is called The Emotions, The Sketch of a Theory. It's a fascinating essay, and one can see in it all sorts of theses which will emerge full-blown 5 or so years later. The central thesis, though, is that emotions are choices, and emotions involve alternatives, options, and most importantly, perhaps, involve a kind of purposiveness which most scholars and psychologists have simply ignored. The key phrase of that early work is a very dramatic phrase. Sartre says that emotions are magical transformations of the world. And what I'd like to do in this lecture is try to understand what that means and to see how it fits into his overall philosophy. What he wants to do with this thesis is, first of all, to get away from a mechanistic picture of emotions as physiological disturbances, the idea that emotions are bodily upsets, which we then experience. Instead, predictably, he wants to show that emotions are choices, and in particular, they are strategies for coping with difficulties, and they are therefore our responsibility and not the source of excuses. His first target is the great American psychologist philosopher William James. James's views on emotions, in fact, are quite complex, and they are often oversimplified. His religious writings, for example, the essay Will to Believe, involves a really subtle notion about the ways in which we can choose our emotions, choose our attitudes towards the world, something that in fact would be very much in line with what Sartre is arguing. But the target that Sartre focuses on is a very famous essay that James wrote in the late 19th century called What is an Emotion?, which he then reworks later for a book and finds its way into his Principles of Psychology as well. In that work, James has one formulation which psychologists ever since have used as the basis of a great deal of their research. And it simply goes like this. An emotion is an upsetting perception which causes in us a physiological disturbance. James at one point says a visceral disturbance, and we are quite aware of what that means. The idea of our stomach tightening up, the idea of feeling flushed, the idea of feeling sometimes cold, but the various kinds of very easily specifiable physical operations of the body, which then give rise to or cause a set of distinctive sensations, the feeling of a visceral upset, the feeling of a chill, the feeling of being flushed. In short, what James argues is that this perception of the physiological upset is, and he both italicizes and capitalizes the word is the emotion. In other words, an emotion is a set of sensations which are caused by a distinctive set of physiological responses, which in turn are caused by some upsetting perception. Nietzsche once says, it is not the least charm of a theory that it's easily refutable. And the truth is that the beauty of James's theory has often been the idea that he is so specific that it is very easy for a theorist to come around and say, the theory is right, the theory is wrong, here's the evidence, and here's the counter-evidence. It doesn't involve such vague terms as affect that philosophers can argue about for ages without ever pinning it down. Anyway, in James's own time, he was challenged, for example, by some fellow physiologists who claimed that the number of physiological phenomena that gave rise to sensations just wasn't expansive and broad enough to account for the huge number of emotions that we experience. On the other side, it was argued that, in fact, although it's true that emotions are sensations with a physical origin, They must be something else besides. And it's this argument, this side of the argument, that Sartre wants to weigh in on. Because Sartre wants to say is that James ignores at least two very important features of emotion. First of all, he will argue that emotions, like all mental phenomena, and here we see Sartre's debt to Husserl, emotions are necessarily intentional. They have intentionality. That means that they are not simply feelings or sensations, but they refer outside of themselves to the world. Or to put it rather simply, emotions are always about something. You don't just love, you love someone or something. You don't just hate, you hate someone or something. You can't just be angry, you've got to be angry at someone, about something. You can't just be sad, you have to be sad about something. And even those cases with what we might call mysterious objects, for example, in dread, what we are worried about is perhaps the unknown, or there is what Freud later calls free-floating anxiety, the idea of being extremely disturbed and upset about something one knows not what. There is, of course, the question of mood, when sadness, for example, expands beyond being sad about this particular thing. But I think it's not a stretch of our language or our conception of mood to say that when one is sad or depressed or joyful, one is nevertheless sad or depressed or joyful about something, perhaps just the state of the world as a whole, or one's own position in it. In short, all emotions are intentional in the sense that they are always about something. And what this means is they can't be mere sensations or feelings because feelings aren't about anything. Or perhaps one can say, feeling is a very vague general notion which encompasses within it both feelings which are intentional, namely emotions, and perhaps those feelings, mere sensations, which are not. But a headache is not about anything. It might be caused by something, for example, your mother-in-law coming to visit. But we don't say that the headache is about your mother-in-law. And similarly, if you have a pain in your toe, it might be because you stepped on a nail. But nevertheless, the pain is not about the nail. But if you're caused to be angry by somebody insulting you, it is not just the cause, it is also the intentional object of the emotion. So you're angry about the offense. You're angry at the person. This is what James leaves out. And of course, one can try and save James by saying, well, he doesn't really leave it out. It's in the realm of perception. But then, of course, we have a new set of problems. James, in fact, says very little about the perception that causes emotion. In fact, sometimes, very much in tune with the psychology of his time, he suggests that these are basically instinctual in nature. And at least some emotions are caused by instinctual reactions, which involve really very little thought, and in fact, very little of what we would normally call perception at all. For instance, there is a kind of natural fear of snakes. There is a natural revulsion of vast quantities of blood. Whether or not these instinctual theses are true, nevertheless, it's pretty clear that in James, in the account of emotions, perception gets very short shrift. One could say that perceptions are always about something. Perceptions are intentional in precisely Sartre's sense. And in that sense, one can say James captures the notion of intentionality in the perception part of the thesis. But then we have some other problems, because it's not the emotion itself that is about something, but it's rather the perception. And to say that a cause two steps removed from the emotion is intentional is not necessarily to say that the emotion itself is intentional. But it gets worse than that. For example, a bear steps out from behind a tree as I'm taking a walk through the woods. This is one of William James's own examples. I have this familiar sensation of queasiness in my stomach, and my knees feel weak, and I feel rather flushed and tense. And, of course, what I feel is fear. What is the fear? It is that set of sensations which is caused by the physiological upset, which is caused in turn by my sudden perception of the bear. Well, not so fast. Let's ask a question. How do we know that the emotion is fear? Just suppose I have just broken off a relationship with a particularly hairy lover. And as the bear jumps out from behind the tree, my thought is, oh no, I'm in love again. I interpret all these sensations as, in fact, falling in love. Absurd? Well, of course. But if you think about some of the arguments that some of James's own contemporaries in physiology had made, for example, that the sensations in the physiological upset accompanying a great many emotions were in fact the same, and yet we distinguish the emotions quite sharply, then you can see that what I've given is really just an extreme example of that same doubt. How do we individuate and identify emotions? You can't just say on the basis of the perception, because the perception, as far as we've got it here, is simply the perception of a fact, namely, here's a bear. And it can't be in the physiology, and it can't be in the sensations that make up the emotion. One has to say that something else is going on here. And of course, Sartre just jumps in with 2 feet and says, of course, the fact that emotions are intentional means that what distinguishes an emotion and identifies it is precisely the kind of thing that it's about. One might again modify James and say, for example, instead of thinking of the perception as just the perception of a fact, namely, here's a bear, what one actually perceives is already deeply value-laden, so that what I see is not a bear, but what I see is a great danger in the shape of a bear. And that gives us some mileage. But even then, it's often been argued, for example, by cynics, that love and the feelings of love are in part impelled by a sense of danger. In which case, my absurd hypothesis that I might be falling in love again becomes at least a little bit plausible. How are we to understand this? And it seems to me that the basic idea is that what James is doing is over-physiologizing the emotions. In James's defense, I should say that at the time he was writing, at the end of the 19th century, this was a bold and very important move. There were a great many psychologists, both American and European, who were focusing on psychology in terms of the measurement of very particular differences in perception and such. And what they were doing was often ignoring the body. And what James was doing, much in tune with some people today, was trying to remind philosophers that they have bodies, and that if you think about what an emotion is, you can't get away from the body. James famously and plausibly says, you can't really imagine anger without the urge to vigorous action. And so the concept of emotion, for James, is firmly tied to bodily response and bodily behavior, which, for the purposes here, he doesn't adequately distinguish. But the idea is that if you're to understand emotion, you must understand the body. Well, Sartre doesn't disagree with this, but he thinks that that's the wrong emphasis. To understand the body and the role of the body in emotion is not to understand the essence of emotion, but rather to understand one of its most interesting and important consequences. Before I get to that, let me introduce the second way in which Sartre wants to correct James. He says, contrary to not only James, but almost every thinker on the subject of emotions, he says emotions have what he calls finality. And here what we should understand is the word finality not in the sense of ending, but rather the sense in which finality refers to an end. The word comes from Aristotle, who talked about the final causes of behavior, where the final cause is basically the purpose. And so what Sartre is arguing here is that emotions are purposive. It's a bold thesis because we typically think about emotions as simply being caused in us, and consequently they don't have a purpose, or if they do have a purpose, they're not our purpose. But Sartre, to the contrary, wants to say that a person who has emotions has reasons for that emotion, whether or not he or she manages to articulate them or even understand what the emotion is. And I want to talk about this at great length later on. The basic idea is that an emotion is a kind of strategy. An emotion is a way of dealing with the world. An emotion, consequently, is chosen, and is chosen for a purpose, for a reason. And for the purposes of this essay, the reasons actually tend to be virtually all the same. What one does is makes a choice to escape from a painful situation. And the way in which emotions do this is something that I'll talk about in a bit of detail. Let me give Sartre's own examples. First of all, there is an example that comes from Aesop, the ancient fable teller. and it is, in fact, a very persuasive example of Sartre's thesis. He talks about the fox and the grapes, a story that we all know, and we still use an expression that comes straight out of Aesop, the notion of sour grapes. The story, very briefly, is the fox sees some yummy, delicious grapes and craves them, but even with all of his fox-like ingenuity, he can't reach them. So he turns away in disgust and says, they're probably sour anyway. Sartre rather wryly suggests, it's not as if the chemistry of the grapes has changed, but what's happened is what Sartre calls a magical transformation of the world. And now let me explain that phrase. First of all, notice that in one sense, it's not the world that changes. The grapes stay exactly as they have been. The fox never touches them. What he does is he changes his attitude. He changes his way of seeing the grapes. He now comes to see them as sour. That's the transformation. One might say that what is transformed is not the world, but rather the fox's way of seeing the world. And that's okay, because remember what we're aiming towards, and the next lecture will make this fully explicit, is Sartre as a phenomenologist, in which, like Heidegger, phenomenology and ontology, the way in which we experience and the way in which the world is, are firmly tied together. So, from a phenomenological point of view, it makes perfectly good sense to say that what the fox does is he transforms the world. But what about the magical? Well, that's where it gets really fascinating. There's a sense in which the fox might actually change the grapes. For example, we can imagine a very spiteful fox who, unable to reach the grapes, takes a spray can and makes them sour by putting a chemical on them. In which case, it's true that the chemistry of the grapes has changed, that in fact, the grapes now are sour. And sometimes we behave like this, ruining, for example, what we can't have so that no one else can have it. But often, what we do is this kind of magical transformation, which means that instead of actually doing something to change the world or to change the situation, we transform it as if by fiat in our minds. And what the fox does here, exemplifying the emotion of resentment, something that Nietzsche talks about at great length, is he refuses to accept himself as a failure. He refuses to accept himself as having been not up to the difficulty of acquiring the grapes, and so instead he sees himself now as a wise fox who is not willing to expend any more energy on such a wasted project. That idea of escaping from a difficulty, of using one's emotions to escape from the world, is the heart of Sartre's thesis in this early essay. He says emotions basically are a mode of escape behavior. And what that means is we have our emotions not because they are caused in us, say by frustrating circumstances, but rather we have our emotions because they are a way of dealing with the world in which we come to see ourselves as better off than we would otherwise. Let me give another example from Sartre, this one not nearly so plausible, but nevertheless I think it illustrates the thesis in a very dramatic way. He's concerned with a young woman in Victorian times who finds herself caught, let's say, at a ball with a bunch of men who are telling off-color jokes. This puts this young, proper woman in a very awkward position. If she walks away from the men and the jokes, she will be labeled as a prude. If she laughs at the jokes, she'll be labeled as who knows what. If, on the other hand, she abuses the men for telling the jokes, then we all know what they will think of her. In short, all of her options are unacceptable, because in all of them, she comes off as being much worse off than she now is. So what does she do? And Sartre suggests she faints dead away. Now, perhaps this isn't a phenomenon that we see very often in the world as it approaches the new millennium, but certainly in the last century or so, such phenomena were well documented and frequent. One can try to explain them through the side door by saying, for example, that the corsets such women wore were much too tight, depriving them of oxygen, and that's probably true. But nevertheless, one has to explain, why did they faint dead away at precisely that moment? And one can add to that a kind of Jamesian thesis because they were flushed with excitement, and that made it all the more serious, the lack of oxygen. But it still doesn't really explain what we want to explain. Here's what Sartre would say, what Sartre does say, that the young woman faints dead away as a way of escaping from her extremely awkward situation. She can't face it, she can't walk away from it, she can't do anything about it, so instead she, in a very concrete sense, disappears. Now, as I said, I don't find that a particularly plausible example. I've actually never known anyone who has fainted in such a circumstance. Nevertheless, we can see the strategy that Sartre has in mind. And what's important here is that it's not as if the woman decides in a conscious, deliberate, reflective way to faint, but rather she just chooses. She just does it. For Sartre, most of our emotions are not reflective. Most of our emotions don't involve deliberation. But nevertheless, and this is again a very important point for Sartre, they do involve choices. And in this case, again, it is a choice to evade a situation which one no longer finds tolerable. There are other examples which I find perhaps not so plausible either. But I think Sartre's on to something very important. Let me give the two other examples just so you get the range. He considers someone who has fallen in love. And one thinks of falling in love in our society, as in Sartre's society, as a very positive thing. But Sartre, who has a very strong skeptical streak regarding human behavior, throws this into question. What do you do when you fall in love? He asks, as some songs have asked. And the answer is, what you do is you act like a fool. You're irresponsible. And perhaps ironically, or even paradoxically, the person to whom you are most irresponsible, most inconsiderate, sometimes even cruel, is the person whom you love. How to explain this? Well, Sartre's argument, again, I think, illustrates the thesis, whether or not plausible in this particular case, and that is the idea that one chooses love as a way of absolving oneself from responsibility for one's behavior. And so, too, with the emotion of joy. And again, we think of joy as a very positive thing. But Sartre, who is a reasonably gloomy fellow at times, says that joy, too, is a kind of escape behavior. That when you feel joy, what you do is you kind of throw off the world. You throw off your cares. And in particular, you throw off all those political responsibilities and obligations with which Sartre himself was so concerned. We can certainly think of examples that bear this out. People whose good moods, in fact, are very obnoxious. And you might wonder, why? Why should I resent somebody's being in a good mood? But you watch their behavior and you see, because the good mood is in fact acting as an excuse for them not to be doing the sorts of things they're supposed to be doing and not to be behaving the way that they perhaps ought to be behaving. In short, the idea is that what emotions do for us is that they act as choices, they act as ways of transforming the world, our world, such that difficulties disappear, or at least in an important sense or in some sense, mitigated. Sartre has a second target, and this is a target that will carry him through virtually his entire philosophy, and that's Sigmund Freud. And the arguments here are somewhat complicated. We'll see them again when we get to Sartre on what he calls bad faith. But there are basically two points of utter rejection. The first is that Sartre rejects the idea of the unconscious, but wants to be very careful here. Because notice I've already said that for Sartre, emotions, for the most part, are not reflective. They're pre-reflective or unreflective. And one might rightly challenge whether there's a real difference between the unconscious and merely being pre-reflective. In neither case is it open to conscious awareness. Is it articulable or readily articulable? And so the question is, in what sense does the unconscious differ from a thesis that Sartre clearly wants to defend himself? One answer, of course, is the rather technical answer that comes from Freud, and that is unconscious mental events are not just those that are not conscious, but they are those that cannot be made conscious. They are repressed. Consequently, it's not simply the fact that they are not in mind or reflective at the time, but it takes enormous effort and perhaps enormous expense and time to make the unconscious conscious. But to understand the source of Sartre's objection, one has to look at a second idea, and that is the notion of what is called psychic determinism. What the unconscious does for Freud is it gives him a way of explaining human behavior, including behavior which previously seemed inexplicable or meaningless, by pointing to the causes which the person, him or herself, may not be aware of at all. The idea here is that every conscious event has its unconscious determinants, its unconscious causes. But if this were to include decisions and choices, if this were to include emotions, then we find that Sartre's thesis is firmly contradicted. And so what Sartre rejects here is any idea that the psyche can be determined by forces outside of it, or, in a sense, within it. In fact, what we'll see in Sartre is that consciousness involves virtually no dimensions at all. It is, as he will say, a nothingness. And that means that the idea of causal relations, either between it and the world or within it, are simply incomprehensible. But back to the idea of emotions. They are not forces within us, as Freud might argue, but rather, they're strategies taken up willfully, even if pre-reflectively. And that raises the question, if they are strategies, and if they are, in that sense, conscious, and Sartre will say consciousness has no place for emotions to hide, then where do we fit in the body? How do we take account of the very good and plausible arguments that James makes about the necessary participation of the body in emotions? Well, I think the important thing is to say, first, that while emotions involve the body, it is not primarily a matter of bodily sensations, which is where James puts the emphasis. Rather, we might say it's a matter of bodily responses. It's been often argued by a biologist, for example, that if you take the physiological disturbances that happen to us in emotion, one can easily see these as part of a pattern. And they would add some of these are more or less automatic, part of the autonomic nervous system. Others are, in a sense, willful. They are part of the voluntary nervous system. But nevertheless, the idea is that if you look at all these sensations and the physiological disturbances that James was referring to, most of them have to do with preparedness for action, getting ready to do something. In fear, getting ready to flee. In anger, getting ready to fight. There's a sense in which James is perfectly okay with this, which is why I mentioned before that when James talks about the body, he doesn't make a very clear distinction between physiological reactions as such and actions as such. The idea is that one can put oneself in an emotion by, for example, acting it out. James famously says, a woman is sad because she weeps. She doesn't weep because she's sad. How does Sartre account for this? Well, by not taking the sensations in emotion as the primary focus, but rather by taking the bodily responses and preparation for action as the focus. What he says basically is that part of the magical transformation of the world is a magical transformation of one's own body. Now, one might take as an extreme example of this the young woman who faints away upon hearing some dirty jokes. But more realistically, I think, one can understand why one feels the way one feels in fear by seeing it all of a complex in which one, among other things, is getting ready to flee. And one can understand the emotions, the so-called emotions of heat and tension and anger, by understanding those not as mere sensations, but as preparation in action for doing something. In short, what Sartre wants to say is that the bodily sensations we're talking about, and more generally bodily responses, follow from the emotion and are not causes of it. But before we dismiss Freud too quickly from this discussion, let me repeat not only the similarity between what Sartre says about pre-reflective emotions and what Freud says about the unconscious, but let me also note that by the time he had written Being and Nothingness, Sartre was also evolving a notion of his own of psychoanalysis. It wasn't Freudian analysis, but it was rather what he would call existential psychoanalysis. And the principal difference with Freud was it was not mechanistic. To put it all into another slogan, where Freud says, I cannot, Sartre would say, I refuse.